Illinois Public Media WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Coming to you live today, September 13, 2009, on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Perhaps no issue so defines our age as technology and scientific revolution, and perhaps no public policy issues are way more heavily than those dealing with the climate, with the environment, with health care, with a whole range of issues that really revolve around science and technology. Yet are we prepared to handle them? We'll have a guest today with a brand new book, Unscientific America, that says we have a real crisis and one that will affect us all. Our guest, Chris Mooney, but before we go to him, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Pentagon officials were forced to admit they hired a PR firm to produce secret background profiles of journalists seeking to cover the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan following an investigation by the Stars and Stripes newspaper, a daily published for U.S. service members in 48 countries. The military now has terminated its contract with the Rendon Group, which prepared the summaries for military public affairs officials. The journalists were rated positive, negative, or neutral based on their likelihood of giving the military friendly coverage. Kevin Barron is one of the reporters who broke the story.
And at the bottom of some of these reports would then go on to suggest whether or not that reporter would be susceptible to good news kind of coverage if given the right opportunities, you know, or if they were the kind of reporter who got a lot of negative ratings, then perhaps they could be neutralized with a different kind of coverage and opportunities.
That the Pentagon compiles information on journalists is nothing new. A vetting process for any journalist looking to embed with the military is certainly necessary. But what the Rendon Group was doing went far beyond the initial vision of the embed program. It tied the media analysis to the denial or approval of a journalist's request. The analysis wasn't being used as a way to screen whether the applicant was a good reporter in terms of accuracy and writing skill, but whether the reporter would write good news about the military.
The Army has rules for this embed system that was created when these wars started in the previous administration. And written right into it says that in no way is this system designed to prevent bad news or embarrassing news about the military to get out. This is supposed to be the military's way of facilitating journalism of the war, of making it happen, getting reporters where they need to be, making sure everybody's safe, all that kind of stuff. It's not supposed to have anything to do with being a way to spin the war, to control reporters, to direct them where to go, anything like that.
Yet journalists who want to cover the U.S. military in a war zone can't get access unless they embed with the troops.
You know, there's a lot of new journalists who are trying to get into Afghanistan now. There's new fighting going on. It's a renewed story. It's getting into the winter. There's going to be more demand for this, not less. And so the more hiccups in this system that we hear about, the more they're going to start to mount up, and you know, we'll see how smoothly things go.
Barron says that the Stars and Stripes investigation of the embedded journalist program will continue.
Internet marketers gather information from virtually every click we make online, where we go, what we watch, and what we buy. They compile the data for what is called behavioral advertising, ads targeted specifically for you. Privacy watchdogs have long warned that too much of this information is being gathered without our knowledge. Now Congress might be stepping in. Rick Boucher of Virginia, the chairman of the House Commerce Committee, is drafting a bill that would impose new rules for how websites and marketers ensure user privacy and safety. Last week, a coalition of consumer advocates and privacy groups called on Congress and the Federal Trade Commission to create a system that's transparent, accountable, and has meaningful consumer rights, especially when it comes to privacy. Susan Grant is the director of consumer protection at the Consumer Federation of America. She wants marketers and websites to stop collecting sensitive information.
Sensitive information like somebody's race, ethnicity, their sexual orientation, their political activity, and other very personal information shouldn't be collected and used for behavioral advertising at all. Some in Congress feel that it would be okay to collect that kind of information as long as the consumer opted in, that is, affirmatively agreed to it. We're saying that that information should be off limits, period, because the potential for abuse is just too great.
Abuse could be in the form of what is called digital redlining, which could impact obtaining credit or accessing government benefits, educational opportunities, or insurance.
Information about consumers would be compiled to profile them and then perhaps offer one person goods or services at less advantageous terms or of lower quality than another person based on that profile.
And there are other concerns about how information gathered by this type of internet spying can be used.
We're also concerned about the possibility for information to be stolen by identity thieves, for information and profiles to be used by the government, for instance, to try to find people who may fit the profile that they think exists of terrorists or other uses way beyond that of advertising.
Grant's first priority for an online behavioral tracking and targeting bill is to make sure marketers and websites can't collect information unless users opt in to the data mining process. She would also like to see the Federal Trade Commission create a Do Not Track registry, similar to the Do Not Call registry. For more information about online tracking, go to consumerfed.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, September 13, 2009. Our guest today is Chris Mooney, who's a contributing editor to Science Progress and the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Republican War on Science. He's also the co-author of a brand new book, along with Cheryl Kirschenbaum, Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future, just out by Basic Books. Chris Mooney, welcome to Media Matters.
It's good to be on.
For starters, Chris, let's just get to basics. Why did you decide to write a book called Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future?
Well, I'm known for sort of blasting the Bush administration for interfering with science. And
We rarely have that on this show. So.
As the Bush administration rolled to a close, I was of the view that while many problems would be solved sort of automatically by just throwing them out the door, there were a lot of lingering issues in terms of how American society grapples with scientific problems, scientific topics, and that they weren't necessarily going to be completely solved. So this book is sort of the sequel, and it tries to look at what continues to prevent our citizenry, our politics, our media from reflecting, you know, accurate knowledge of science and most importantly, putting it to use in public policy.
And a little bit, your co-author for the book is Cheryl Kirschenbaum. What's her background? What was her role in writing the book?
She's a young marine biologist, and she is turning into a science journalist, even as I'm a journalist who became more and more interested in scientific topics. So we've gone in opposite directions. And we collaborate on a lot of stuff now, including our blog, The Intersection, and this book sort of grew out of conversations that we had together.
And if people want to go to your blogs, where would they go?
It's on the Discover Magazine website, so it's blogs.discovermagazine.com/intersection.
Now, a lot of times, you know, when people hear about scientific illiteracy, we're all familiar with the surveys that show that, you know, I don't know what percentage it is, 20, 30, 40% of Americans think that the sun revolves around the earth or believe in creationism, et cetera, sort of basic scientific numbskullery. Is that what your book about, sort of how dumb people are and what a problem that's going to be that we have so many dummies in our country?
Well, we mentioned those surveys, and they're very bad, and it's, you know, 40% and upwards on some of those things that you're mentioning. So clearly people don't know much, and clearly it would be better off if they knew more. You know, it's not cool to have a society that hasn't really undergone the scientific revolution in terms of knowing the Earth goes around the sun and things like that. Or, you know, one of the most important parts of the scientific revolution is the Darwinian one. So we shouldn't be rejecting that kind of stuff. But I think the book tries to go farther in saying it's not just people are stupid. It's people don't have a lot of opportunities, and we have a variety of structural disconnects that prevent, you know, good scientific information from getting through to the most influential parts of society where people aren't stupid at all in the political system, in the media. Well, maybe some people are stupid there, but, you know, generally, you know, the problem is not ignorance. It's a problem of translation. It's a problem of science not getting through.
Your argument is that science is under assault, and we're going to go through that over the next hour, the ways, the institutions, what's happening that is undermining science or making science less valued in our society. Why is that a problem exactly? Why? I mean, you know, a lot of Americans probably feel like, hey, you know, I didn't really like science in school. I don't know much about it. There are some experts who are handling all this. I'd just rather, you know, do my own thing and read fiction or watch ball games or go bowling.
Well, they're entitled to use their time as they wish, but the problem is, I guess, twofold. First of all, the people who say that to themselves, who say, science is not for me, I'm not really interested, they're selling themselves short, and they're also probably disadvantaging themselves, because if you really get science, then what you do is you're empowering yourself to make better decisions about any number of things, how to choose your health care, you know, how to decide what kind of energy you get, all these kinds of things. A scientific way of thinking will set you up and make your life better, I would argue. So there's that. There's the sense of empowerment that comes from scientific knowledge and a scientific way of thinking. And then, you know, perhaps even broader from a public policy perspective is the fact that if you don't get the information right, then you don't make the decisions right. And that's what we've seen. You know, global warming is the canonical example where we've been fighting over the science, and basically people have been attacking the good science for two decades, and it's created gridlock, and we've been unable to get the policies that we need.
Another way that science is a public policy issue, Chris Mooney, that was really interesting in your book, and I don't think many Americans are familiar with it, is the degree to which the very existence of basic scientific research in our society is dependent upon federal subsidies, that this is really a public subsidy that we even had the emergence of this vast scientific infrastructure.
Yeah, it was a brilliant decision made, you know, half a century ago, you know, in the wake of World War II and in the wake of Sputnik, that we were going to be a society that invested vastly and systematically in knowledge, in universities, in research enterprises. And so we've done that, and we continue to do it, and it put us at the head of the whole world in terms of science and innovation. And yeah, everyone, that's a big public policy issue to keep it going in that way.
And, well, I mean, the numbers, as I recall, and I'm doing this from memory because I don't have your books, the page open to me, but we went from something like just a few million dollars of spending on science by the federal government in 1940 to $12 billion two decades later?
Something like that. You know, I'd have to open up the book, too, to get the precise numbers, but, I mean, the point is definitely correct, which is that following World War II, and then especially when it got the super oomph, was following Sputnik, when we wanted to be competitive with the Soviets, Congress and the society decided to invest in science. And we created all these agencies, the National Science Foundation, NASA, which was going to be the home to the space program, which, you know, 10 years later made it to the moon, and all these careers, you know, there's all these funding of university research positions and college scholarships to be in science. So the amount of investment went up dramatically during that time period, and it really built the research enterprise that we have now.
And especially, and I think this is a distinction scientists know secondhand, but the rest of us might not know as well, the money went to support what's called basic research, which, as I understand it, is the sort of research commercial interests aren't going to support because it doesn't have immediate applicability, but it's the sort of research that leads to the sort of advances in knowledge that are the basis of all applied research.
That's right. A lot of the federal research budget, and especially monies coming from the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health, are supporting basic research, which is just learning the way things work. And it's rare that you have a corporation that's willing to do that much open-ended stuff. So the idea is that you get some ideas and then they can be seized upon by a company to turn them into technologies. We do invest in a lot of what's called development, too, especially the military. But, you know, but a lot of U.S. science funding today, which is over $100 billion a year, is not basic. It's actually, you know, applied or development of technologies.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Chris.
Oh, no, I just wanted to add. And then corporate America, you know, in terms of the government science budget, I forget what the exact figure is per year for research and development. It's well over $100 billion. But then corporate America is generally, you know, that's only a third of the total research because corporate America makes up the other two-thirds.
Our guest today, Chris Mooney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILLAM 580. Chris Mooney is the co-author with Cheryl Kirschenbaum of the brand new book, Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future, published just out by Basic Books. A terrific read, if I may say so. Having had one of the pleasures of my job is I get to read books like this and acquaint myself with issues I wouldn't know as much about otherwise, and one that's very important, especially in the realm of media, which is the topic of this show and my own particular interest, because as this sort of scientific infrastructure built up in the second half of the 20th century in the United States, a key component of it, you argue in the book, was the emergence of science journalism. Explain what that was all about.
Well, even as this was happening, we had a society that turned towards science in a big way. Because of Cold War reasons, broadly speaking. And so it wasn't just that we invested a lot of money in research, but at the same time, media outlets were investing a lot of money in coverage of the new research endeavors. So, you know, the space race, front page news, you know, during that time period constantly. And so a lot of journalists were trained to be a particular kind of journalist, which is the science journalist. And it's an important role because the science is technical, and so you need this intermediary who sort of breaks it down and then makes it usable to everybody in the society, theoretically, through a general interest kind of publication like a newspaper. Because even the science magazines, the readerships of those tended to be the science-centered people, and the material was often fairly technical in a place like a Scientific American or something. So you needed newspapers and you needed TV news to be breaking it down and making it usable to the citizenry. And so that those careers were created then, and since then it's been a pretty big decline, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, your argument in the book, a key part of it is sort of we've seen the rise and fall of science journalism over the past five or six decades. And give our readers some sense of the nature of the decline over the past 10 or 15 years, or even the last few years, because I think you put it in rather graphic and even chilling terms in the book.
Well, yeah, it's sort of an accelerating problem right now. I'm here at MIT. I'm in a science journalism program, which is a great program, the Knight program, for a year. And everybody here in the program with me in the last class, too, you know, we're all thinking we've got a year of a fellowship, but after that, what are we going to do? Because the career we thought we were in is starting to not exist anymore. And everybody knows the horror stories of science journalists losing their jobs now. It's partly tied to the demise of the newspaper industry, it's in incredibly bad straits. It's not dead. So there's just a lot less staff positions at newspapers. And when buyouts are happening or when reporters are being laid off, it's often tended to be career science journalists who are deemed, and they're not the only kind of journalists that are losing their jobs, but they're often among the first to go.
I mean, if I read the book, you were recounting that it seemed like two-thirds of all science sections in newspapers have been discontinued in the past decade. Is that right?
Yeah, and again, I think it's accelerating.
Yeah.
Because what you had was, that was over the past couple decades. I forget the figure, but, you know, the figure cut off at 2005, mm-hmm. and that was before the real crisis of the newspaper industry. So now what you see is some of the really big, important ones that were holding on, where you would expect science to continue, like, you know, say the Boston Globe here, because that's where I am. I'm in Boston right now. They just recently cut their science section.
Our guest again, Chris Mooney, co-author of Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future, published by Basic Books. If you'd like to call into Media Matters, the phone number at WILLAM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And so we lose this media coverage of journalism, of science. The journalism is sort of lacking. How does that affect issues? Let's take a very tangible issue that you write about in the book, climate change. What does not having good science journalism mean when the public considers the policy options on climate change?
Oh, I think it might make almost all the difference. So let me preface that by saying that, you know, science journalism is in bad straits now, but when it comes to the coverage of the climate crisis during the 1990s, for example, even then, the way the issue was covered was still lackluster. My argument is only that it's going to be worse, not better.
Okay.
So what happens is you lose specialists in the media, and you have a media that's, you know, focused on eyeballs, entertainment, not as much on, you know, informing people about complicated public policy issues like this one, which is a very complicated one. So what you're going to get is you're going to get episodic, occasional treatment. So global warming, you know, flits onto the screen and flits away again, and you don't hear about it again for 3 months. So it's unable to be on the agenda. And then when it is covered, what you'll get is journalists who don't know much about the issue, who are prone to various kinds of misinformation, of which there is much, and much of it is being put out by special interests specifically to muddy the waters and confuse people. These journalists won't know, because they're not specialized science journalists, how to handle that. And how to handle it is not to, you know, not to fall for it. So you'll have a media that's credulous and susceptible to agenda-driven misinformation. So it's a sort of 1-2 punch, where you're not going to get sustained attention, and the attention you get is going to often be hijacked and misleading.
You know, some of the, in the case of climate change and global warming, some of the, whether it's paid for by the oil companies or some other special interest, or whether it is independently produced, comes from people who, to the casual observer, to the untrained eye, seem to have all sorts of academic credentials. Their reports have lots of footnotes and endnotes. They seem to know technical jargon. They have graphs and charts. It doesn't seem like hocus pocus. It seems like they're producing science, making the case against climate change or global warming being a concern. And you're saying good journalists should be able to separate the wheat from the chaff when it comes to this issue?
Absolutely. I mean, it isn't that hard. I've made my whole, you know, sort of science journalistic career out of doing this particular thing. And there's a lot of other science journalists that are quite good at it. But it's not something you just automatically know how to do, because it turns out that it's quite easy to create scientific-sounding nonsense. And there is a whole industry to do it, and the people in the industry for doing it, the think tanks, the corporations, and so forth. There's a lot more money behind that than there is behind us who are trying to, you know, with the scientific journalism jobs disappearing, who are trying to set the record straight. So it's kind of a tough competition to be in, and you really need the journalists to be attuned to the fact that this stuff happens and not to fall for it.
A lot of people think, Chris Mooney, that the Internet will really solve our problem of the decline of science journalism, or the decline of journalism, traditional journalism with newspapers or broadcast networks in general, because the Internet will, you know, gives access to this wealth of information, sort of unimaginable wealth of information. So it will empower people to really bypass the journalist and really get to the bottom of things and get past the junk, as you've called it. Your book is not that optimistic about the Internet as the solution.
Yeah, I mean, if that's what's supposed to happen, I haven't seen it. And I'm speaking from the perspective of someone who's been in the blogosphere since 2001. I started a political blog with the American Prospect magazine, which still exists. It's called Tapped. Back then in 2001, and then in 2003, I created my science blog, The Intersection, which is one of the first science blogs, and so it's been around since 2003. There weren't that many science blogs back then. Now there is a vast profusion of them. So in one sense, it's true. There's an incredible wealth of science information online, and the figures that we get from the National Science Foundation, I believe, show that people are increasingly going online if they want to find something about a specific scientific topic. And online you can find, you know, great debunkings of all this kind of nonsense we've been talking about. But there's a big problem. The problem is one of audience and of choice. You know, who is going to go actually do this? And my argument is that it's only a small segment of the population that's really going to the science-centered information that exists on the web. And so it doesn't replace what's being lost in a general interest newspaper, where you're really reaching a diversity of people, rather than sort of the people who already care. The information rich, you know, will know where to find the science, but I'm not sure everybody else will. And then there are other problems. So, for example, you know, the anti-global warming people, the anti-evolution people, the anti-vaccine people, they all do just fine on the Internet, too. You know, they're very popular on their sites, just as popular as the good scientific information is. So people who are interested in that kind of stuff go to it. People interested in good science go to it, and most people don't go to anything at all.
You mentioned just now the anti-vaccine movement and the argument that vaccines are the cause or one of the contributing causes of autism. I've only heard a little bit about this, I confess, and I guess some Hollywood celebrities are promoting this as well. Mm-hmm. And it's the little I've seen of it. It has not been critical. It's sort of been presented as like they were doing fundraisers and stuff, like a legitimate enterprise. But this is a completely bogus movement.
Yeah, I've done some reporting on this. I did a big feature story in Discover. And let me just run through it. So it turns out that the original concern about this mercury-based preservative called Tamiflu in vaccines was, to me, not crazy. You know, you probably don't want... It was a very small amount of mercury, but you probably don't want that in there, all else being equal. So it's good that it was taken out of most vaccines, and that happened about 10 years ago when the concerns were originally raised. So then the question became, okay, mercury was in, now mercury's out. Was there any harm? And so for 10 years, scientists have been studying this using epidemiological studies, and they're just not finding it. You know, study after study says no, you know. And the biological reasons for thinking there probably wasn't any harm are pretty strong, because just the amount wasn't that much. So there's no evidence suggesting that, you know, that this has caused some kind of increase of autism. There may be an increase of autism, but if that's happening, it could be for other reasons. It could be partly an increase in diagnoses. So previously conditions were being missed that are now being called autism. So a scientific consensus is forming that that Tamiflu didn't cause any increase in incidence of autism.
Yet this issue has a half-life despite the scientific consensus.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, because there's an incredible investment in this. So you mentioned celebrities. Jenny McCarthy is sort of, and Jim Carrey are sort of the top people who have been pushing this idea. And McCarthy is proud that she got her scientific information from the University of Google, as she puts it, which I think epitomizes how just rampant misinformation can be on the web. And there's sort of a whole conspiracy theory out there about how the government suppressed, you know, information about the dangers of vaccines, and there's been a cover-up. And, you know, if that was so, then you wouldn't expect the scientific results to be so unequivocal, because it's really hard, I think, to enforce a conspiracy across the world scientific community. You know, there's not that much walking in lockstep. There's an incredible incentive in science to prove something wrong, to undercut what seems to be accepted. So I think that with the amount of studies that have come out now, if there was something to find, you probably would have found it.
Our guest you're listening to just now is Chris Mooney, the co-author with Cheryl Kirschenbaum of the brand new book Unscientific America: How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future, just published by Basic Books. The phone number here at Media Matters, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment, 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our phone lines now to some callers who have been waiting patiently. Line 1, Urbana, welcome to Media Matters. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mooney.
Hi.
Glad to hear from you again. Can you confirm what seems to me like a situation where in perhaps someone, a scientist or someone knowledgeable in one particular scientific area is kind of put on a pedestal that, oh, yeah, this guy, you know, is, or woman has, you know, studied, and they're involved at a level that no one can really understand. And that separates scientists and the world of science from quote-unquote general population.
I'm not completely getting the question. Are you saying that the science world creates idols?
No, I would say that would not idols, but creates a. Oh darn it! Well, I think that actually, those covering science, who are not, who are actually fairly ignorant themselves, separate those who do know how to communicate science and kind of, you know, elevate scientists and their knowledge unjustifiably, and put them in a separate category away from the general population.
And so maybe we don't subject the science people to enough criticism.
Or to enough coverage. Here's kind of an odd take. Why aren't there more scientists on The View or something like that to talk to a general audience, because they're not entertaining? I don't know, but...
Yeah, well, I mean, so people who cover science in the media, you know, those remaining, they certainly have their flaws. And in terms of scientists communicating themselves, some of them are great at it, and some of them are just terrible at it, and the scientific community doesn't put that high a premium on being a mass media communicator. The premium is on publishing really hot research that gets cited a lot. So so there's a variety of different kinds of communication problems out there, and you know, you can sort of pass the ball, and it's everybody's fault in a lot of ways, but the journalists drop the ball, and the scientists also drop the ball.
I mean, you talk about in the book, Chris Mooney, you discuss at some length Carl Sagan and the role he played in the late 1970s and 1980s in popularizing science. I mean, there is this, and what was the importance of his experience?
Well, Sagan is, I think, hands down the greatest popularizer of science of the second half of the 20th century by far, and that's just, you crunch the data on the kind of audiences that he reached through television, through the Cosmos series, through film, through his best-selling books, and I don't think anybody really comes close. So Sagan was very, very good at this and was a household name because of it, and what we point out in the book was that Sagan, drove a lot of people to be interested in science. Sagan did a lot to shoot down a lot of bad science being promoted by the Reagan administration in terms of the Star Wars program and things like that. So Sagan had an incredible impact, and Sagan should have been, if anybody should have been put on a pedestal, it should have been Sagan, but it turned out that some people in science, and by no means all, but some people in science were either jealous of Sagan or were, didn't think it was appropriate for a scientist to be popularizing this much, or thought he was guilty of oversimplifying and dumbing things down. So it turns out that people gave Sagan a hard time, when I would argue that's the last thing they should have been doing. And one instance of this was that he was denied tenure at Harvard, but another instance of this was that he was also not made a member of the National Academy of Sciences when it came up for a vote, which is sort of the elite society of science.
But I think you've hit on a very important point that it's not just true of the sciences, but across academia, that scholars who are doing public outreach and translating for the general public and sort of reaching out to the non-academic community of their peers, I mean, I think there's an assumption that those people then can't have the time or the interest to do the hardcore, serious research that the field's based upon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's also a sense that, why are they getting so much attention when they're not really moving the ball forward in terms of fundamental knowledge, and I am,
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of, sort of infighting based on that stuff. It turned out with Sagan, it's complicated because he did do important fundamental research in certain areas of planetary science. Maybe not as much as someone who just spent their whole career doing just research, but he did have the original science to back him up, too.
Our guest, Chris Mooney, co-author of Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. This is a live show, so call in at 333-9455 if you'd like, or 1-800-222-9455. We can talk about anything. We've got a lot of ground to cover still. You know, one of the issues, Chris, that comes up when you think about this is the way Americans are taught science in K through 12 before they get to universities or graduate programs. And I'll just speak from my own personal experience. When I was in school, studying science was frankly very unexciting. It was presented as a set of received facts that I memorized. And none of the excitement of science, of the mystery and the challenge, was really ever made clear in the study. I remember biology, I really had no sense of the theory of evolution, what that really meant, linking humanity and our species to all of life. Instead, I was just given a lot of Latin terms to memorize, and I did okay simply because I have a good memory, but I didn't know anything about biology when the class was over, and I had no interest in the subject. How much is the way, and since then I should add that I've got a great interest in evolutionary biology, but it's been purely nothing to do with the education I got in the subject.
Your story sounds exactly like mine, and I suspect that it's a story that's very common out there. There's a lot of problems with science education. In fact, I've heard probably 7-10 theories about what the problem with public science education is. I mean, first of all, the creationists are out there trying to undermine it constantly, so it's under assault people are even afraid to teach. But then there's, you know, more like the problem you suggested, which is that, you know, we have to teach to certain standards, so teachers have to make sure that students memorize certain facts that they know are going to be on the test. And somewhere along the way, we forget to get them to realize how powerful this information is and how much meaning it can have for their own lives. And instead, it ends up being dull. It ends up being boring. It ends up being a turnoff. It ends up being hard, and people say, this is not for me. I'm not one of those people who does science. I'm one of those people who does something else. And they define their identity that way, and then they go through life that way, unless something else wakes them up and gets them interested again. So that's a real, real big problem. And part of it is also that, you know, we don't pay teachers well. This is notorious. So, you know, the really talented people who could maybe engage students maybe aren't choosing to be teachers in the first place because they know how difficult their career it's going to be. So science education is in a dismal state in the United States. I should sort of bracket that and say there are also some schools that do science education great, but, you know, there isn't equal opportunity because it's great or it's awful, you know, across the country. So that's an incredibly big part of the problem, too.
You mentioned just now the religious right and the attack on the theory of evolution and the co-creationist thing. You know, how significant is that? How much of an important factor is this sort of anti-intellectualism that the religious right in many ways exemplifies with regard to science a factor in sort of the decline of science in America?
I think it's really pretty huge. I mean, you've got half the country, roughly, something like half the country, that refuses to accept, you know, one of the biggest and most important insights that science ever gave us, maybe the biggest, which is who we are, where we come from. You know, we have an incredibly powerful answer to that question, and that is we are part of the animal kingdom, you know. We share a common ancestry with the rest of life on Earth. You've got half the country not just, you know, ignorant of that, but actively rejecting it and actively resisting it. It's being taught. I think you cannot underestimate the fundamental importance of that. And they're constantly fighting over it. They're constantly starting battles in different school districts over it. And you've got the same part of the population, the Christian right, broadly speaking. The very word evolution is a negative word to them. And the very word science, because it's so synonymous with evolution, is a negative word to them to a significant extent. So it's a huge part of the problem.
You know, there are people like Richard Dawkins and a handful of others, Sam Harris. But Dawkins probably, I think, for the sake of this discussion, is the most important since he's such a prominent evolutionary biologist who have written about, you know, it's time to basically just fess up and say, look, atheism is the only, you know, religion is contrary to science and, you know, it's disproven by science. And Dawkins wrote his manifesto a couple of years ago and traveled around the world promoting it. And basically saying, okay, if you guys want a war, here's the war. You don't think that's the right approach to dealing with the religious right, I take it?
No, I think that I explained just how bad the problem is in terms of resistance to evolution and how much it holds us back. So I think that the religious right is a very, very real problem. But I'm not at all convinced that polemical atheism is going to do anything to diffuse the religious right. I think that, if anything, it's likely to entrench the religious right and give them more, you know, more enemies to attack. I mean, you know, the leaders of the religious right would just love it if Richard Dawkins was broadly seen as, you know, the epitome of the scientific community, because then they could say science is just atheism, you know, and science is out to destroy your faith and tear any, you know, vestige of meaning out of your life. And that's, you know, the scare tactic that they've been using to begin with to keep people away from evolution. I just think that that if we really want to make inroads in this country where everybody's so polarized and where, frankly, the Christian right is, you know, living in, many of its adherents are living in hermetically sealed environments where they've got, you know, their community, everybody thinks like they do. You know, they've got their pastor who, you know, repeatedly reiterates the same information and that they all share, and it's hard to even break through to begin with. I think that you cannot go head-on at religious faith and expect to make inroads. I think rather what you need to do is you need to show that religion is diverse. Religion offers many possibilities. Many forms of religion are not anti-evolution, and that why do you have to you know, stick with this one particular extreme form when there's so many other forms that would let you have an acceptance of modern science and also retain a religious kind of meaning that's important to you. In other words, I don't think we move people all the way from fundamentalism to atheism most of the time.
Well, my sense in Dawkins' argument is not that he's specifically just going after the religious right and the creationists, but basically the whole foundation of religion is anti-science. I mean, there's a conflict there that he says we just have to be honest about, and that, you know, if we're honest about it, you know, we just have to recognize that religion and science are oil and water.
Right. That is part of the argument. So I guess I discussed it first as a matter of strategy, if you want to make diffuse American creationism. But then Dawkins would disagree with my remarks on strategy, because to him, people in the, quote, middle ground on religion, so people who, you know, accept evolution but also retain, you know, faith, perhaps they're Roman Catholics, because Roman Catholics don't always, most of them don't, they don't doctrinally have to have any problem with evolution. So Dawkins would say, you know what, you're still anti-science because you still believe in unseen, unprovable things, and you accept on faith claims that don't have any evidence behind them. And, you know, there is a certain power to that argument, because it's a very absolutist position, and it just says, you know, if you don't have evidence for something, you know, there's no reason to believe it, period. That's why I'm an atheist, because I don't have any evidence for God. And that's, frankly, personally, if I can speak personally for a second, I find that very persuasive, and that's why I personally am an atheist. But I don't see why we have to, you know, forego strategic allegiances with all these moderate Christians who, you know, are struggling to reconcile their faith with modern knowledge and, to some extent, do a pretty good job with it. I'd rather just let them, you know, sort things out for themselves, as long as they're not trying to ram it down my throat, as long as they're not opposing evolution, you know. I don't think we need to alienate them, and I don't think we need to fight with them. So that's the difference. I see the force of Dawkins' argument, but I don't see the use of it.
Our guest you've just been listening to is Chris Mooney, the co-author with Cheryl Kirschenbaum of the brand new book, Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. Chris Mooney is also the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Republican War on Science. I urge people to take a look at this book if this interest, this topic interests you. Our phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the toll-free line right now. Line 4, Columbus, Ohio. Welcome to Illinois. You're on the air with Chris Mooney.
Well, hi. I'm really honored to be on your show, Professor McChesney, and especially when you have such a good speaker, interesting topic here. I have a couple of questions, and then I'll get off the line. My first question is, I've been listening to a podcast from the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama and a number of monks from Dharamsala, India, have been getting together with various scientists in biology and physics, astrophysics, and various disciplines, and they've been talking over comparing what the Dalai Lama calls Buddhist science with and exploring consciousness and so forth with these people. And I was wondering if you've checked any of that out, first of all. And second, I was wondering if you have looked into any of these science curriculums that are used either in grade schools or high schools and so forth. There are some, like, independent curricula, like Jane Goodall has one called Roots and Shoots. And just curious to see if any of these curricula have come your way. So thank you very much, and I really enjoy the program.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Chris Mooney?
Yeah, I'll take the second one first, because I have more to say about the first. So I'm familiar with some alternative science curricula. There's the, you know, Leon Lederman has proposed Physics First, which I think makes a ton of sense. I don't know Jane Goodall's, but Physics First is just, you know, why on earth do we teach high school science with biology first, then chemistry, then physics, when physics is the most fundamental units of matter, and then you build up chemistry and then biology on top of that. So the logic of the structuring of how science is often taught is precisely backwards. So I think that there's a lot to that particular argument. Now, the Dalai Lama and neuroscience, I mean, this is an incredibly interesting point to bring up to the whole science and religion conversation, because here you've got a religious leader who doesn't see any reason why scientific understanding has to be in contradiction to his particular faith. And the Dalai Lama has said, I believe, that if science proves some tenet of Buddhism wrong, Buddhism will have to change. And right now he's been, I think, very interested in what neuroscientists are finding out about the brain and what kind of light that might cast on things like meditation. So I think that this is an example of how science and religion can coexist. You can't have them coexist if religion demands and asserts that certain scientific tenets be not adhered to. There really has to be a very tolerant approach on the part of religion. But there also does need to be a tolerant approach on the part of science, and just say, there's a lot of people out there who have some particular religious belief, and nevertheless, they're able to do research, they're able to make scientific insights, they're not opposed to any knowledge, rather they see the world as the creation of God or whatever it is that they believe in, and that actually lets them be appreciative of science in the first place.
Our guest, Chris Mooney, author of Unscientific America. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to WILL AM 580. Your previous book was The Republican War on Science, Chris Mooney. And in this book, it's infused with the notion that the Obama administration is much more pro-science, much more respectful of science, much more nurturing of science than was the W. Bush administration. We've had on this program over the past 6 or 9 months several guests who've been, to be blunt, disappointed in the Obama administration across a number of issues where campaign promises have not been fulfilled and where policies have veered far closer to the Bush administration than to what the campaign rhetoric had promised. What's the score look like in science?
I got to tell you that in science, that's not really the perception. It's just the Bush approach to science was seen almost universally by the community of research as so bad. That when Obama came in and started appointing, Nobel laureates to energy secretary and a leader of the scientific community to science advisor and unleashing a lot of new funding for science, I mean, just doing those things are so good and such a reversal that I think he's bought quite a lot of tolerance for a while. I'd have to see, what it would take to make the scientific world unhappy with the Obama administration, but so far I haven't seen it. I do think that probably more could be done. It's hard with so many issues on the agenda. I mean, I'm worried about global warming and whether we're really going to get legislation and whether the administration is fighting hard enough for it. Because we need it, and we need it quickly, and whether the legislation that we're going to get, if we do get it, is going to be strong enough. But still, even there, I mean, it's a 100% sea change from Bush that we're going to try to get any legislation.
What are some of the other big issues, Chris Mooney, where science, policy issues, huge issues, that where science plays a central role and where scientific understanding and knowledge is really lacking among our legislators, in our media coverage, and among the public?
I guess there's the obvious one of stem cells. And, that's one where Obama has sort of put the issue, I think, to bed by changing the Bush policy. So that's a pretty huge one. In terms of what I really care about, I'm trying to look, as a journalist and as a person who cares about science policy, I'm always trying to look 10, 15 years ahead to what we are going to be fighting over, what we are going to be struggling with. And here, I think that there's probably 10 issues that are coming that almost nobody except for people who follow science closely know enough about, and that we're not going to be prepared for.
Give me a few of the ones that listeners might be interested in keeping tabs of.
Global warming is not being addressed quickly enough at all. That's not the issue, but we'll get to it. And because it's not being addressed quickly enough, if it's being addressed at all, we're going to have a huge planetary problem, which we already have, but it might get completely out of our control. And when that happens, I think, and scientists think, it's on their radar that we're going to be tempted to geoengineer the planet. In other words, we're going to be tempted to try to remake the Earth to not receive so much sunlight, which is probably within our technological means. And it might be the only way of cooling things down again if we can't, you know, get our crap together and agree on a global climate treaty, which we're continually failing to do, and the problem may already be gone. So we have probably the technological capacity to change the Earth's temperature in an artificial way. Almost nobody knows this.
How would it be, and this is mind-boggling, how would something like that take place?
Well, you just simply have to blast into the stratosphere, or, you know, use planes to carry it into the stratosphere or whatnot, various reflective particles that will stay up there. They're called sulfate aerosols. Will stay up there, and they're known to have a cooling effect. And the problem is you'd have to keep doing it, and there might be some unhappy side effects, but you know that you would be able to cool things down because not as much solar radiation would be getting through. So it's been said that a crazed billionaire could do it right now without asking anybody. But certainly it's going to be more and more tempting, and scientists are studying this, publishing papers on this very regularly. Scientific societies are endorsing statements about the ethics of doing this. I mean, this is coming, but it's not on anybody's political radar.
Okay, anything else? That's really interesting. I don't know if you can top it, but can you come close?
Well, there's like 10 of them, because science is constantly changing the world. And so you look a little bit ahead and you say, what's coming? And you say, oh, my God, are we going to be ready for that? Let me do another one. So synthetic life, synthetic minimal genome life is what it's called. This is Craig Venter's thing, where he's going to create, synthesize small microbes out of nowhere. In other words, in the laboratory, he's going to create life by piecing DNA together. And we are very, very close to achieving this. And the idea, the argument, is that this will be great because we'll design these little critters who can do an environmental cleanup. So, you know, there's an oil spill, and you put this particular kind of microbe that we've synthesized on the oil spill, and it chews it up, and suddenly you've got clean water again or something like that. That's the ideal. But I don't know. People might be rather uneasy with this idea, and what else will these things be able to be used for, and will we be able to synthesize bad ones, and will somebody, you know, figure out how to do that, and will this become a new threat? So that's another topic that, again, it garners almost no public discussion, but someday these kind of things are going to suddenly be upon us.
And these will all be, I assume, public policy issues. I mean, they will require governments to sort of weigh in on their legitimacy.
Yeah, they may well. I mean, I think that without a doubt, geoengineering will. I think that with synthetic life, it might be that if, you know, something is created and there are no serious concerns, then people might just forget about it after a little bit of uneasiness. But anyway, you can run through the list because there's so much potential constantly for new innovations to change the way we live. Another one would be human life extension. You know, what if we may be getting close to a pill that can let us live 10, 20 years longer. What will that do to our society? So you could just go on and on, and you'll find the same thing. Nobody's talking about these things except scientists. Scientists think these things might be very likely and might be very soon.
Chris Mooney, we've only got about 5 minutes left. There's a couple other important issues I do want to take up with you before we wrap up today. In the book, you talk about the importance of Hollywood and its portrayal of scientists and how that affects the scientific literacy of the nation. We'll talk a little bit about that, if you would.
We have polling data that says that only 18% of Americans know a scientist personally. So that's why Hollywood is important, because the other 82%, insofar as they get some information about what scientists are like, it's probably coming from Hollywood, because these are the most dominant portrayals of science and scientists. So we look at what those portrayals have been like, and we find a number of stereotypes that have been pretty negative and pernicious. The stereotype of the mad scientist who, you know, is going to destroy the world, maybe through geoengineering. The story of the nerdy, socially dysfunctional scientist who's an oddball and not like you and me. And those have been very, very prominent. There's some evidence to suggest that they're not as popular these stereotypes are not as popular as they used to be, which is all to the good. But it's clear that we have sowed some pretty deep stereotypes about what science is and what the people who do it are like, and that they're pretty negative ones.
And, you know, I was talking with Bill Moyers a few years ago. I don't know if it was on the show, but it was somewhere. And he mentioned he'd given the commencement address at City University of New York a few years back, I think in like 2005 or 2006. And all the PhDs were there from engineering and sciences. And he said that virtually all of them were not from the United States, that CUNY's PhDs were international but not Americans. So the impression I get from that bit of evidence and from your book is that this crisis of science literacy is, you know, is not a global phenomenon. It's an American phenomenon. I mean, other countries are not going through the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly some countries where science isn't doing very well. You know, I mean, in sort of fundamentalist Muslim countries, I don't think science is doing well or evolution is being taught any more than it is in, you know, probably less than in America. But if you look at, you know, sort of the Asian countries, you know, you look at China, you look at Singapore, you look at South Korea, man, they know that science is the future, and they are putting all their weight behind it. So we are going to have some incredible competition from other countries. And the difference is that, you know, America's already, you know, it acts some in some sense like it's already had its scientific heyday, and it's sort of the big leader and doesn't have to worry about it, whereas they, you know, they're coming from behind, and they're happy to see us falter because they know that they'll just blast on by. So we still are not really awake to the fact that science is becoming something that globally people are aspiring to have, and that we won't always necessarily be the leading country.
Let's go to one final caller and see if we can get one little quick call in. Let's go to line four. Portland, Portland, Oregon, or Portland, Maine?
Portland, Oregon.
You're on the air with Chris Mooney.
Hi, Chris.
Hi.
You know, there's this NASA review panel that recently published a report stating that NASA is unprepared to extend human space exploration beyond low Earth orbit. And I'm curious how you think the current tenor of the media coverage will influence congressional funding decisions.
Of this topic?
Yes.
Gosh. I'd hate to guess. I don't know that I've seen this topic being covered that much. There are specialized science committees in Congress that do pay a lot of attention to NASA, so I think that they'll be on the ball. But I'd hate to say anything more without enough knowledge of the particular area, unfortunately.
Well, Chris, if I can add in, because in one of the article you wrote in The Nation with Cheryl Kirschenbaum, you mentioned in that piece how the Houston Daily newspaper had laid off its correspondent.
Oh, yes, that's true, yeah.
And, you know, but it led to the point that, you know, so much of our space program was built on a really successful use of public relations and developing really positive press coverage. When press coverage basically ends or, you know, is reduced to basically people who just pick it up on the side but not full-time, you know, science correspondence, is this going to affect the science program or the space program?
Okay.
Excuse me.
But that way, I guess I would say that, yeah, I mean, given the size of the space program that we, you know, that we have, the fact that it's not being covered is a real problem, because it's a very important public policy topic, how much we invest and how the program is doing. And I think in terms of Congress, you know, if we're not getting enough information out there, through the media, then they too will probably not have this on the radar as much. So I view this as part of sort of the general decline of attention to science in America. But the thing is, I guess the reason I was hesitating is because I don't have strong views, because I don't have enough background on the particular course the space program should take.
Chris Mooney, we've only got a little bit of time left. Real quickly, could you tell folks again where to go if they want to follow your blog and learn more about your work and Cheryl Kirschenbaum's work?
Sure. The blog's The Intersection. blogs.discovermagazine.com/intersection. The book's got a website, unscientificamerica.com. We're on Twitter and all the rest. So,
well, I want to thank you so much for taking time from your busy schedule, Chris Mooney, to join us today here right on Media Matters. And good luck with your book.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Chris Mooney, the author of Unscientific America, has been our guest today in Media Matters, the book just out with Basic Books. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Melissa Trentz for doing a terrific job as my producer, Kyle Krohoff for working the board. And next week, we'll be back 167 hours from now with Eric Bohler talking about the blogosphere and how it's revolutionizing politics. Join us then. Until then, have a great week, everyone. See you then. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, a beautiful day today with sunny skies and warm temperatures, a high of 81 degrees. Tonight, mostly clear, and there's a chance of patchy fog tonight after midnight, the low around 60. Monday, mostly sunny with a high of 82. Monday night, mostly clear with a low of 58. And Tuesday, partly sunny with a high of 82. This is Illinois Public Media W.